very powerful. Quite powerful.
Can honorable members take their seats? Trying to find out who else is here. Honorable members have agreed in our last meeting of the committee that in order to give meaning to what Parliament has tasked us to do as the adult committee established to consider and report on the Green Peace and Tailwind by the Minister and the Office of the President, Minister Manuel, in Parliament. We had followed the process that we all agreed on, that receive written submissions, go through those written submissions, shortlist those organizations that we think it will be necessary for us to engage with them over and above written submission. As per agreement on Thursday, that this morning we start with what we have termed or classified as a group of professionals or individuals that will represent mostly the environmental sector, insofar as their contribution towards the Green Paper. And later on during the day, there are other presentations that will follow. In terms of our program, I must indicate to the presenter, it is not our wish to undermine your efforts, your energy, your initiatives, take the trouble to come and meet with a representative body of Parliament in terms of the time that has been allocated to you. I must indicate that planning is quite central to what government needs to do. And this planning needs to happen as soon as possible. And given the time constraint that Parliament has, we have got very little time on our side to go back to Parliament and report our observations, interactions, and recommendations to the House. And it is within that context and the positive spirit that we have allocated you a minimum time of an hour per session. I am told Dr. Christo is here. You're supposed to be accompanied by Harold Winkler, is he here? You are a backbencher. Why do you choose to sit at the bank?
Because I don't know.
No, no. You are invited to join us so that we can address you properly and have parliamentary protection for the duration that you'll be here. We know we did not communicate to you that you should coordinate your presentation, but we think you should summarize both your presentations to us or your contributions. Then we'll then engage in terms of deliberations and debate. I guess Dr. Christo will be the first. Are you ready? Thank you very much. Over to you. And members of the media or representatives from the media are all welcome, and other people from other organizations who are sitting in this house, you are all welcome. This is a national program, it's a national project, but also our participants must participate in shaping us. how government should look like at the end of the day, and how should each actually plan and coordinate its activity. Thank you. Over to you, Doctor. Use the mic. We don't have a roving mic, Doctor. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Let me just indicate there, Doctor. Doctor, sorry. Just summarize your input. If there's additional information in writing that the committee, you feel the committee requires further engagement, you can leave that with us. Thank you.
Okay, with regards to the green paper, first comment would be about the definition of our task. Our definition of task came through in Nelson Mandela's speech on the 10th of May 1994, with bread, water and salt. The green paper starts with a very nice preamble of why we need to develop, why we need to go forward. This is actually going to take us quite a while, so where we already have a definition of task. The task is to build state. This is motivated again by the Millennium Goals, NEPAD Strat, as well as our individual provincial growth and development strategies. Unfortunately, the Green Paper also says that our growth has been pedestrian. I agree with this fully. We need to actually get down and get our local and regional state departments empowered capacity to push forward. IDPs in the South Africa Integrated Development Plan for Municipalities. The last time I spoke to a friend of mine, he says only 25% actually get handed in at national level for approval. This actually shows that the weaker municipalities aren't actually doing it. There's also a very big problem with infrastructure, we've got a problem with the migrant labor. The Green Paper mentions we haven't changed our economy for the past 100 years. This is guaranteed because of migrant labor. It is a very big misconception, I believe, of the people involved. And with that, they think that the big cities are the only places with work. This isn't true. I've been working in a rural area, Campbell, Kianuma, Pisikatsini, Northern Cape. It is classified as the worst HDI, Human Development Index, in the country. We don't have infrastructure, we don't have training, we don't have water, we don't have people, we don't have land, we've got nothing. Back at the ranch, if you look at the historical background to the town, you could probably make it the biggest tourist destination in the Northern Cape. But due to lack of vision and forward thinking of the municipality and the state departments, we haven't moved forward in Campbell or Sianuma. Why I say the municipality is a problem? They shut us down in our project in 2007. The reason being, the land does not belong to the people. The last time I checked, I'm a training provider. Training institutes don't belong to the people. I've never seen when I was studying at Tuckies, I did not own the university. The lecturers didn't own the university. The university belongs to the state. Furthermore, the municipality shut us down in 2007, Department of Social Services shut us down in 2008 after signing two service level agreements. Since then, we've actually been to the Premier's office, of which they've not come back yet. And that was on the 12th of May that we saw them. So now we're at Top Shop, and hopefully we can actually get integrated rural development going nowadays. Big problem. The guys, I believe, the people, the bureaucrats on lower levels have not realized or comprehended integrated development. The floor here is terminology. If anybody ever says to me we are working towards job creation, sustainable development or upliftment, I want to get sick. A 15-year long-term strategy requires long-term terminology. Job creation is wavering. I'm in a career now of adult education and training. We've got to push people through change management to think of long-term focus. Career creation, empowerment, progressive development. To sustain life is easy. I'll give you an intravenous drip. I'll keep you alive in a coma for the next 20, 30, 40 years. Enough intravenous feeding and you are sustained. Sustainable development is wrong. This was a term used in 1992 by the World Health Organization for the first time, and we took it into infrastructure development. A business has to go through a serious amount of progress before it becomes sustained. Even a sustained business like Click and Pay or the larger retail centers are still progressive with technology. We've got to focus on progressing our country forward. With this, I also want to just mention sustainable development. Technically speaking, we don't even need this commission because our country is sustained. As per the State of the Nation, 2009, 12.4 million social grants. SASA has a quarter of our country on social grants. This is a growth of approximately 11 million grants since 1999, as per the State of the Nation 2009. 9 million of those grants are children grants. The scariest story I ever heard in Campbell was the harem. A father of three children, three girls, gets 1,500 rand a month from social grants to sustain himself a DSTV dish. Because why must I work for so if I can make money through my children? We are a caring nation. Maybe we should define the word caring. Caring is a 3-month support system. Through the National Skills Fund, we can retrain our country. We can build the infrastructure. We can actually go forward. The governance process. The governance process, as defined by the Green Paper, is policy development, strategic operational planning, resource allocation, implementation, performance and monitoring evaluation. Implementation is not possible, it has not been possible, it is pedestrian. Because people have not moved forward, people are scared to work. I've heard every excuse in Campbell. It's too hot, too cold, too windy, too rainy, too far. To build our country, we have to actually get down to sacrifice blood, sweat, and tears. It's the only way we're going to do this. It's not going to be nice for the next 15 years, not going to be fun. But we've got to get down and get our people working. With work comes opportunity. With opportunity, everything goes down. Our crime rate disintegrates. The man is busy working, he does not need to steal. These five factors in the governance system are all quantitative. They're measurable in time and money. The question is, what is the quality? Quality is added once we start reflecting on our processes to move forward. We learn our lessons from our past. Whether it's a good lesson or a bad lesson, a hard lesson, we've got to learn, and this will actually change our character ethic. The Floyd Campbell, the people who work, are usually the policemen, the school teachers, and the municipal workers. The actual example set to the children of Campbell is, I can sit in my car, I can sit behind a desk, and I can sit behind another desk and make my money and be, so to say, have a good job. Note the word again, job. Job is short term. We can't use the word job. Department of Social Services, to provide sustainable livelihood. What is a sustainable livelihood? The livelihood itself is already dead. I can still sustain me. A job can't sustain me. It gets worse because the members from social services are also working with a extended public works program, which is guaranteeing 500,000 jobs with a minimum of 100 days employment per annum. I don't think any of us can actually break even on a year's on 100 days wages for a year. We're actually promoting seasonal work. In fact, the people who live, unfortunately, in Pettenberg Bay, they're waiting literally for December for the tourists to arrive. That's not a career. That's sustainable living. That's 100 days of work. I don't want to work 100 days per annum. I want to work at least 250. Take off weekends of 104 days. That's good work. Okay, deficiencies in the system. I believe there's a lack of knowledge and comprehension. I bumped into the IDP manager, LED manager in Douglas once. And I actually just he's tight in the municipality, and I asked him, what are the criteria of the Freedom Charter? He doesn't know. Our country's constitution is based on this, its foundation principle. You can't be sitting in a state position if you do not know what the principles are or the history of where we come from. So if you know where we're going forward to. These are the foundational principles. When I walked into the doors this morning, the second point is we are under the law of the Constitution. Fabulous. The catch is people don't know what the general principles are. I was unfortunately a Boy Scout for many years, and there you just know your law. You know it. It's not a question. You know your promise. Likewise, if you want to sit in state, whether it's from the presidency to a municipality, you've got to know these are the core criteria of our State Department. This is the Constitution. These are the goals, these are the priorities, these are the strategies. Volunteerism and short-termism is motivated by many slogans. Sustainable development is short-termism. Helping South Africa out is short-termism and volunteerism. If I help you out, I do not expect anything in return. We must stop trying to pacify our consciences because people are dying. We've actually got to go and do something. The best one yet is, how can we help you? I think that's a slogan from a large bank in South Africa. But last time I checked, I walked in, I said, can you help me out? I want to go and buy a car. And they smiled at me and said, what assets do you have? I said, what do you mean, what assets do I have? How can we help you? If I'm helping a friend of mine out with 100 bucks, I'm not asking for money back with interest. Oh, they helped me with my student loan, but I paid it back. They helped me with my car, but I paid it back. That's not help. I think we're getting a problem there with terminology. Yeah, the plan is a caring nation thing. I want to laugh every time I hear that because to care, I don't know, okay, a parent cares for his kids, but basically the kid has to become an economically viable person when he grows up. We do have problems from our past, but we've got to push forward to get infrastructure for employment. Social maturity has to improve. Emotional intelligence has to improve. A lot of great terms. It's hard work. It's sacrifice. And I wouldn't speak to me about sacrifice because after 4.5 years, yeah, it's been a long road. Okay, what do we need? We need to ensure that comprehension is there. We have to mold a synergized theory into practice using systems theory and application to actually go and do. According to the green paper, we've got the plan, and then we've got, as it rolls down, medium-term strategic framework. So the plan is for the presidency, medium-term strategic framework for the provinces, but unfortunately the action plans actually have to be implemented by the municipalities. We have to capacitate the municipalities to get the work done. There are 186 municipality areas, 25% of them can be set to perform. Unfortunately, last week I read the mayor of Pretoria was booed off the stage. River Lee, which is next to Soccer City, they said, no houses, no soccer. We're working on an international scale. The world is going to turn around and say, why are we not playing soccer? We can't have the excuse as South Africans We didn't give the people houses, now we don't have soccer. It's not an excuse. The world is not going to take any excuse. Sorry, we're late. The brochures weren't printed. The people didn't like us. We've got to anticipate this. We need the new mental model. Personally, I've got a mental model. I designed it in 2002. I've tested it in Campbell. It can work. Okay, it's called Diamond Theory. In essence, it basically understands project management theory from definition of tasks, planning, development, implementation, assessment, reflections, lessons learned, and that affects your character ethic. And this, as soon as you get the cycle right, you will balance your politics, which is your past, and your physical environment. With that, you will balance economic and social development. And then it gets really blown out of the water because I followed it through on a PhD, and it ended up being many pages of typing. But that's the essence of it. Awareness has to be followed by anticipation, anticipation by accountability, accountability by adaptability. Every province is different. Every province has to have its own unique strategy on how to implement the national goals, which are depicted already by the NEPAD priorities and the Millennium Goals. And all of this, ironically or beautifully, actually comes all the way back to Nelson Mandela's original speech: work, bread, water, salt. Considering that in the past year we've only changed the substructure of state, we have to figure out how we're going to actually hold people accountable now. There must be some system. Under labor law, everybody has a certain amount of credibility or accountability within their work. If the presidency is at the top, municipal managers fall within the system. We can actually take every municipal manager, every mayor, and actually ask them, what have you done to reach your IDP?
Okay.
Sir.
I think we should move
up on the IDP. That's all I wish to say, actually. So the thing is, it's just about the accountability. The goals have been set. We've got beautiful books for every province. The Department of Provincial and Local Governments has set up strategic plans 2007-2012. These two state departments are accountable to the presidency. Now, the presidency might have changed, but the goals haven't. And the thing is, to bring through the policy of no tolerance for lack of competence. We've got the National Skills Fund, we've got training providers. There is no excuse why we can't push our country forward. Change is not easy, it is uncomfortable, but we have changed in 1994. Now the fact is, I think we're stagnating, and I think the first time I ever saw the screen paper, I actually saw hope. And now we can actually push it through and make that hope into an action plan of note. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor. Honorable members, as per our agreement, you would note the issues that you'd want to raise with the presenter. But we'll then move straight into taking the second presentation so that we interact with those presentations simultaneously. Harold, are you ready?
Yes, thank you. Thank you. My name is Harold Winkler. I'm an associate professor at the Energy Research Center at the University of Cape Town. I'm going to talk to you about the areas of energy and climate change. I think you would have received my comments that I submitted in writing, and right at the front of those comments is basically summarized here in six main points, which I will speak to. I won't be providing you with any additional written information that will explain what I'm here to suggest in relation to the Green Paper. And I agree very much with Dr. Christo that the Green Paper really is a signpost to me as well. The first point that I wish to make to members is that climate change is actually an energy economic issue. Chair, you introduced these set of environmental issues, and indeed climate change is an environmental issue, but I think the way in which it really stands out is that it goes to the heart of our economy, and particularly of our energy economy. The reason why this is so is that our country's economy has been described as built around minerals energy conflicts. We're heavily dependent on coal, not only for electricity, also for some parts of our liquid fuel, and that in turn makes us use energy in a very energy intensive way. That's our history, that's where we come from. And then you could include the mining sector in that. Essentially, what climate change does is that, and the issue of energy security, is say that future path is not going to be viable in the long term. It's going to be absolutely essential that we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions for the size of our economy and our population is extremely high. And there will be a constraint on carbon. In fact, the South African delegation, of which I'm a member, will be going to Copenhagen to a negotiation in December this year where this will be on the agenda. The other way in which this, and that then basically puts the challenge to us that we have an opportunity in meeting this challenge to actually redefine what we mean by our competitive advantage. For a long time, we've said that lies in cheap electricity in particular, that regardless of climate change will no longer be true for very long, as I think we're reading in the newspapers. But it certainly poses those questions. And the last point in which this is a strategic issue that it is really in the long term through climate change itself. But the impact of climate change, things like sea level rise, increased spread of vector-borne diseases, shortages of water, actually have the potential to undermine any path of development, never mind a more sustainable path to reach that development. So essentially with that first point, that climate change and energy economic issue, what I'd like to say to the members present here is that I really believe that this should be part of the core business of the National Planning Commission. And that leads to the second point, in fact, is that we shouldn't, that I believe that energy and climate change shouldn't just be treated as special topics, but indeed should be part of the core focus of the National Strategic Plan and of the National Planning Commission that's been proposed. I've made part of the case for that from a climate change point of view. Let me add to it from the energy point of view why this is so. Just one other reason for this lies in the fact that we're dealing with infrastructure that has long lead times and has long lifetimes. So to build a coal-fired power plant, it takes 5 to 6 years. Wind is slightly quicker. Different technologies have different lead times, but it doesn't happen. And once it's built, we used to assume when we do analysis that these have lifetimes of 30 to 40 years. In our lead tour, by Eskom, once you extend it to 60, 70 years. So the plants that we build, make no mistake, we need to build with all the energy efficiency, we'll need to build a lot in the coming 2 decades, partly because a lot of plants are old. But what we build now will be around by the time, long after we die, and it will be around when our children are still there. And either we are locked into a continuation of the carbon-dependent path that we're currently on, or we move to other paths that build, for example, around solar power or other forms of renewable energy. So moving on then to some of the more practical matters relating to having made the case that this should be part of the core business. The third point that I wish to make is that we believe that we should turn scenarios that we have, particularly for climate change mitigation, and we did some work here, I bought a couple of copies on the long-term mitigation scenarios. This was done with a group of strategic thinkers ranging people all the way from Eskom and SAPO to environmental NGOs across government departments, local governments. And went to Cabinet, and the scenario is basically what Cabinet said, was that our emissions need to peak, plateau, and decline. Now, what do we mean by this? What we mean by this is that basically we need to draw a curve where our emissions are growing rapidly, and we need to start bending that curve. We firstly need to start slowing down that growth in the next years, and Cabinet said somewhere between 2020 and 2025, actually need to stop growth. We need to slow down the rate of growth, and that's where it stays. That's the peaking part. The plateau part is basically remain flat, maybe don't grow at all for maybe another decade, and then within the time horizon that we looked at here by 2050, actually need to decline in absolute terms, so that actually what the science requires of us, the science of climate change that's expressed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, requires that we actually have absolute reductions in our emissions, at least by 2050, a kind of numbers that are being negotiated are halving global emissions by mid-century. That will require a significant change in our energy economy, in a way in which we not only plan but actually carry out, implement our energy supply, and the way in which we use energy, which we use much too wastefully. We're going to have to make do with less as well after our energy conservation. That leads me to my fourth point, is that where I think the what is laid out in the green paper could be improved upon by the fourth point being defining clearer links between broad goals and local sectoral planning. Now, clearly I understand that in the green paper there's an attempt to have high-level planning, and it's really important not to get bogged down in what's called micro-planning. But I believe that those kind of really high-level plans, if they are going to be implemented, it has to be very clear how they articulate the things like integrated energy planning, and even more importantly, integrated resource planning. Integrated resource planning is essentially about electricity. So it sounds like a broader concept is actually narrower. And the responsibility for that used to lie with the regulators, now lies with ESCOM in consultation with others. And we've just seen a proposal we believe that a proposal like that is making the round, also linked to what we've seen, which is the multi-year price determination. Now, unless the high-level plan, a national strategic plan, is actually able to say something about the electricity plan, and then is able to use that high-level authority coming out of the presidency to say, yes, there will be a change, we will move from, instead of building Kutsul, we built the Angkor tree, we're going to move to some alternatives. That is, then it will remain a plan rather than something that's implemented. And of course, that energy planning should start with the perspective of development and poverty. It should start from what are the energy services that ordinary South Africans require, rather than supply-side master plans. And those of you who follow the energy sector know that during the electricity crisis that we face, that's exactly where we've gone. We've reverted to a kind of supply-side approach. The first point that I wish to make is that it relates to this again, is that yes, it is important to drive from the top, but implementation happens on the ground, as I'm sure you all aware of. I think the placement of the national strategic plan in the presidency holds real potential. And I think one of the biggest potentials that it holds is that when you do that planning at the sectoral level, you often get involved in blockages. And quite frankly, since you offered up the projection parliament to the chair, these are often about vested interests, people not wanting things to change, people believing that coal and nuclear power are the only ways in which we can get better electricity, which as an academic I think to achieve the continent is simply not true. And it's in those kind of situations that one really needs the ability to cut through, and I think the location of is well considered in that regard. In line with the main point that I'm making, that energy and climate change should be part of the core business of the National Planning Commission, I believe that there should be commissioners, at least one on climate change, possibly two, one on adaptation, one on mitigation, and also at least one with real expertise in energy. It is such a core issue, not only in South Africa, but globally now, the issue of energy security, that I believe that this is warranted. And then the final point really relates to, my sixth point relates to consultation. I believe consultation must be broad and real. I think the Green Paper does well in spending several pages on consultation. It tends to conceive of this in consultation within government, which clearly is important if there's going to be coordinated activity across government. But it clearly needs to be broader, and the Green Paper does acknowledge that. It refers to NEDLAC. But I think in addition to that, some of the processes that we ran, for example, in coming up with these scenarios, this is not just a study, this is, we had a facilitated stakeholder process where, as I say, not on a representative basis, but we got the best strategic thinkers that we knew to actually come and say these numbers are not only good modelling or good analysis, but we actually have some buy-in in them, and I think that would be really important, and I think after that process, that's not just a one-off process up front. But I think it's absolutely critical about the proposal in the Green Paper that relates to performance monitoring and evaluation. If I've got the title right, the work that's going to be done by Minister Chabani's group is absolutely essential. I think that consultation must also include that government sets very, very clear goals. The climate change strategies would be expressed in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, or maybe initially in terms of greenhouse gas emissions per gram of GDP that we produce. Set them clearly in the consultation process, report on them publicly, and measure progress against them and report that progress every year. So they can actually see, they can give you an example. We've got a goal for renewable energy, for example, 10,000 gigawatt hours. Personally, I don't think it's enough. That's beside the point. The point I'm making is we don't know where we are in terms of meeting that goal. And when the National Planning Commission sets goals, I think that process of setting clear goals collectively with across government, business, and civil society, we need a clear process of reporting and knowing where we stand, so that if we're not getting where we believe we should be getting, we can ask for course. And with that, I'll end, Chair, and happy to engage on questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, let me just say, Harold, you are very short and direct to the point, and thank you very much. And I think this gives the honourable members the opportunity to engage with both presentations. The presenters are both here. They'll identify questions of clarity that relate to their presentation. Honourable Singh, followed by Honourable Feynman and then Crowley.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to the presenters. I think my question is directed to Dr. Becker. Is it Becker or Berber? Becker. Dr. Becker, I think some of the points you've made, especially the weaknesses that you've identified in your Northern Cape example, are highlighted in the purpose of the Green Paper. I think there's an admission by government that there certainly are weaknesses in coordinating government activities to provide good service delivery. Now, in your written document that you sent us on page 4, you say we need an agency to ensure comprehension and application of the planning cabinet. What do you envisage there? What kind of agency? Is what is being proposed in the White Paper, the Planning Commission, something that you think that you want to assist government?
That's my agency, I guess. So I see this as a marketing spiel. The thing is, to get everybody aligned, we need a single mental model on how to think. I believe our greatest enemy is our mind. Our mental model, unfortunately, is trapped within the negativity of being a South African. I will say, across the board, we are a design negative country, whether it is from, this is actually incredibly hard because it just sounds totally wrong, but please throw some salt. But the thing is, through previous oppression, whether it is the Afrikaans white man who believes he still is underneath the English crown, to different tribal systems actually disagreeing with each other, everybody's feeling slightly oppressed and done off. According to the Freedom Charter, we are free. Governments actually just take in that freedom of being economically free, politically free, physically free to actually be South Africans and take up our rights as citizens. And the thing is, the agency in itself just makes sure that every single state department, from the presidency to a municipality, a local municipality, are working on the same path to think, aka everybody can define the same task, plan in the same line. It's not what you think, it's how you think. From an academic perspective, you don't go to school to learn what you think, you're learning actually the skill of how to think in a level.
Can I say you shouldn't respond immediately? Allow questions to be asked, and then I'll give you an opportunity to respond because there may be a number of questions that will be directed to you. Thank you.
My questions are to Harold Winter. I completely agree with your presentation that I think we do need to make a part of the core business of this planning commission. I would argue, though, that perhaps also we need to look broader than just climate change. I mean, perhaps we also should be looking at how we use our resources in South Africa broadly, not just around energy. I mean, would you support such a concept that, for instance, we need to look at how we use water, how we use coal, how we use energy, how we use renewable energy. So in a sense, the Planning Commission should possibly look at kind of natural resource usage in South Africa and how that could be a possible constraint to future growth and then how we plan in terms of dealing with those particular constraints. The other issue, though, is that, I mean, the energy planning, which you mentioned here, one of the concerns that I have at the moment, as you say, these decisions will buffer them for the next 30, 40 years. But these decisions, I think, are taking place at this particular point in time. And the Planning Commission should take about 2 years, I think, to actually develop the plan and to get that going. I mean, how do we deal with the fact that short-term decisions need to be made around the electricity supply now and the fact that the Planning Commission will only really come out with a comprehensive plan in about 2 years' time? How do we deal with that particular problem? And then I think also, I mean, as you say, energy is vital to economic development, but I mean, it could also be the other way around, that in the sense that we could be looking at how we build up a new industrial base through looking at new energy technologies and how we actually use this as a spur for economic development as well. And I'd just be interested to hear your comments on that.
Honourable colleague, you'll be followed by Honourable Marasha from Basu.
Thank you very much to Dr. Becker. You may have mentioned in your presentation about failure to meet medium-term strategic framework goals and also Millennium Development Goals. What were you intending to convey to this committee about how important it is to meet existing goals before you move on to new plans and goals?
Thanks. My question is for both, Doctor. That will I be right if I say we all accept that we are moving from a premise that says we are a developing nation, and as a developing nation, the constraints that we face are different from constraints that are faced by developed nations, you know, and that also applies to the resources. So that sometimes you may say this is the solution, but only to find that the resources to effect the solution are less available to you than they are available to developed nations. But my second question, because I agree that these areas must be addressed, but I read over the weekend, I read somewhere that some of the most developed countries do not appreciate as yet that there is a danger of climate, you know, there are emergencies to the way we are treating climate as the world. And they emit more gases. So if we do, what will you suggest should be a way of getting them on board? Because even if we do our part, but if we can't move with the rest of the world, then our efforts may not amount to much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, more particularly to Dr. Winkler. I think that it would be tempting to speak to this committee as if we're resolving content issues. Because I think that the issue around the energy mix and mitigation, reducing emissions and so forth, are issues which have appropriate fora in which they need to be debated out. I think that the key question that confronts this committee is whether people who are in academic circles, in the industries and so forth, feel comfortable that the green paper becomes a vehicle for such comprehensive planning in which there is a rational framework to make the trade-offs. Because that's the question that I think we come to answer. It's not to debate the issues about what energy mix and renewables and all of those kind of things, it's whether you think that there's an intelligence developing in the way in which the government understands itself to make the proper choices. So, for example, does the green paper give you a sense of comfort that you can now do the trade-off between what you need immediately and where you need to move towards in the long term. What is the optimal energy mix now? Carbon heavy, but eventually renewable. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is, are you comforted also by the example one set up where energy security is, for example, put forward there? I would have thought that maybe it would be useful to hear your comments about whether adopting the methodology of the Green Paper and applying it to energy security as the example in that box, whether you feel that we're beginning to think correctly about those kind of matters. And whether the, lastly, whether the consultation process is set up, how we bring the expertise together, and I've heard you make a pitch for how many climate change experts should be on the commission. I think that helps us to create the balance of forces within the debate. I'm just thinking much more that we're here to critique a methodology as opposed to simply advancing the content issues. And that for me is the fascinating thing about the discussion that we're having today. We can leave the passion, for example, about the issues and really see whether we are creating the vehicle to deal with issues correctly going into the future. And I'd like to hear whether you think we're on the right track.
Doctor, let me start with Professor Harold Winkler, and then we will follow by Dr. Fisher. In that order.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for those questions, which I think are excellent. Firstly, in relation to Mr. Craig, and I certainly agree that there's a broader issue than climate change, and yes, also including what Bremer Sources asked, yes, of course, there's a degree of comfort that you can look at things in a broader context here. I would say, however, that shouldn't take us away from the specific focus that climate change brings us, because I think we've seen very clearly at the international level, and I would argue also at the national level, that the debate around sustainable development, whatever we think about the term, has been fairly moribund. There's no real action on that, and either when you look at the Commission on Sustainable Development internationally or nationally, we have a national framework for sustainable development, what has really happened. What climate change has done is basically revitalized that debate and given a focus to that issue. And there are very, very concrete issues about what is the next power station that we build. Do we build another coal-to-liquid plant in Maputo or not? That has actually revitalized that broader discussion about sustainability. And so I would say, yes, I think there should be that interaction. Certainly my particular comments came from the perspective of energy and climate change, but even within that, the issue that you mentioned of water is an issue. One of the key constraints on building a new power station is the availability of water and the whole issues around that. In relation to the question about short-term decisions, I don't have an easy answer. I think that's a very important question. I do think that a real test of the system that has been, and just in response to Mr. Rasool, I do think that I made both points on process and on content. So in relation to that, one of the points I do make in the submission, I think the litmus test of the plan will be whether it can actually affect the decisions about building power plants, for example. What I think, the only thing I can think of right now, that I do think particularly around the integrated resource planning process that is currently underway, that in and of itself that should have a broader consultation process than it's currently still being done in the rather secretive culture of ESCOM. And I'm afraid you're going to have to remind me of the third question, though, right? I think that's absolutely critical, and I think our economic development is energy has been part of our, has been core to our economic development and will continue to do so. I think we need, quite rightly, a methodology that enables that to happen in a different way, so we don't have to create jobs not in coal mining and coal-fired electricity, or employment, I would actually agree, rather than short-term jobs. We have to create long-term employment around other forms of producing energy, and indeed around energy efficiency and conservation. Since I'm on the theme of these two, I'll go to the other of a number of Paul's questions. I think my overall question, answer to your question is that yes, I think there's a lot of, from my perspective, there's a lot of comfort that there is a more comprehensive equilibrium, and that there is a lot of very intelligent thought that's gone both into the planning and into the monitoring and evaluation as part of it. The issue that I was trying, and particularly example one did stand out for me, but in the process point that I did try to communicate to you, I think what I was trying to say is that yes, there is a sense that there could be a good methodology for an overarching plan. What is not sufficiently clear to me is how that overall plan articulates with the sectoral plan. Does it have the power to override? If there's a stated intention that it could unlock blockages, I think that would be excellent, particularly in the question of electricity planning. But it's not clear how that would happen, because at the same time the paper is saying, well, we won't do micro planning. And so that's not, I see, it's not clear to me the methodology. I'd also just say as a personal comment that no, I won't leave aside the passion, because I think it's important that even when we're setting up the methodology to remember where we're going with this in substantive terms. And I'm sorry, could you remind me of the other member's name? Absolutely. I mean, we understand South Africa as a developing nation. Now, what that means, I think, from an academic, intellectual point of view, is really changing. I mean, there's a very clear distinction between a developed world and a developing world are actually emerging. But as a matter of climate negotiation, it's very clear that South Africa is a developing country. And when we undertake action on climate change, it's a different matter. And it's because we have really, I would just highlight three things. When you try and do these things in a context where you have extreme levels of inequality still in this country, I think we're ranked number one on the Gini coefficient, which measures inequality still. We compete with Brazil on this dubious honor. It's very, very different, and we're trying to address high levels of poverty. So we're at the same time trying to address how do people like you and me use energy when we drive to work, we use all the services all the time, and how at the same time does it affect someone living in rural Transkei? And it's a very different, it's the two countries, the two economies issues. We're trying to deal with these very difficult issues, and development trying to address poverty in that context, which is very different. In a context for developed countries, where there are much narrower bands, basic needs are not completely, but much more fully met. I think there are very few amongst the developed countries who no longer accept the science. George Bush, when he was in office, certainly questioned it. He sent it to his own National Academy of Sciences, and even then, in the Bush administration, got back the message that no, this is indeed real. The new Obama administration has no question about it, but has a very strongly science-based position. What is not yet the case, that they're not drawing the real and full consequences of that science and being willing to two things potentially, to really commit themselves to very radical, and they really are radical reductions, they're not easy to do in terms of their own emission reductions. They're basically saying, we've done so little for so long, we can't go that fast down. And then they also need to provide some of the resources in terms of the negotiation, in terms of technology, finance, and capacity building that would assist countries like ourselves. So, for example, let me give you a practical example that we would actually be looking to them to build that concentrated solar power plant that ever since I got to UTT in 2000, I've heard it's been planned, but to actually get it on the ground, because this is now a matter of risk here. We're basically saying, if someone puts 3 billion rand on the table, they need another 3 billion rand for the first plant to basically share the risk. And so I think I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Paul. Doctor?
Okay, with regard to failure to meet existing goals. To answer, I'm just going to hand out one of my handouts just to explain to you, sir.
that all?
Okay, the thing is, the handout, I'm going to be leaving it here for everyone, but the thing is, on page one, it's basically just a comparative study between the priority development target for the Northern Cape, the state of the province, source June 2009, the IDP of Sierra Numa, which is my municipality, and then the goals of my project, which was basically shut down by Sierra Numa in 2007, Department of Social Services 2009, and I still haven't got no response from the Premier's office. With regard to the failure of existing goals, if you look at the Sierra Numa goals, most of them are 2008. These goals were not reached. I speak from my perspective. I am the training provider in Sierra Numa. I unfortunately have not trained. So I can't see how the goals could be reached. It just gets a little bit rough when you actually drive around and the goals aren't reached. And the project by its design was an integrated synergized project where we actually would have handled decentralization of population, peace and security, democracy, agriculture, housing, skills development. Yeah, it is possible to actually build cities if everybody is working towards the same goal at once. Okay.
Thank you. Honorable member said our presenter, I think we might not have done exactly what you wanted to do, but the overall thrust of your presentation does back your presentation and your submission. And therefore it does allow us as the committee to be in a better position to can process your thoughts. But from where I'm sitting, without trying to summarize your presentations, I think the overall thrust of the two presentations is that the green paper, as envisaged, it does give hope for the country, and therefore planning is very central to what we need to do. From yourself, Doctor, you also highlighted the importance of coordinating integrated development plans of all spheres of government, your provincial growth and development strategies, your LEDs, and your national plan. It's very, very, very important that you do so. The professor has actually said also to this committee, it is very, very important to put at the center of planning issues of climate change and related matters. I think it is very, very, very important that we take those contributions into cognizance with the committee. Obviously, the excitement about the green paper is that it has generated so much energy that we are beginning to gravitate into the content of what the plan should entail. And there's no harm about that thinking, not at all. It does indicate to us that the government should then take this process as serious as ordinary citizens and the institutions and individuals that you represent very, very seriously. Now, therefore, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you very much for coming here and share with us your concerns and also contributions into the process itself. Thank you very much. We'll take 5 minutes break and take the next presentation from the Law and Society. Thank you. You are welcome to remain behind and listen to other presentations. But if you've got other businesses to embark on, you are free to leave. Thank you very much. We'll not interpret that as a walkout. Thank you. In terms of our program, honorable members, they're supposed to be taking a presentation from Intel Project. They have indicated that because of time, and that they represent, in fact, it's an association of many law firms. They have not been able to put a delegation together, but one of their representatives here just to observe the proceedings, and therefore they're not making a presentation today. Eight law. Eight law project is here. You know what? I'm very much sorry. I apologize because somebody spoke to me and I thought I was presenting you. Okay. Then we'll take your presentation, move quite fast on it, and then later on we'll then take your vote, booster, and the chamber of mine. Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't even record your name, but just introduce yourself so that everybody knows.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Jonathan Berger from the Eight Law Project. We're not a membership-based organization. We're a Section 21 company with our own board of directors, and we represent no one but ourselves and the issues that you speak to. I'm not going to go through our presentation in detail. Honourable members have the presentation. I don't have anything to add to the presentation, so what I will do is really just focus on a few key issues. Firstly, what is our interest in this matter? Why an organization that focuses primarily on HIV and the law, why are we making a submission on the Green Paper on National Strategic Planning? Secondly, to summarize the key points, that's the five key points that we make, but I only really want to speak to three of those key points, and those are the points dealing with trade-off consultation and the structure of the National Planning Commission. So that is really the point that I would like to make today. I think the starting point, before I get into our interest, the starting point is that our submission, as you have seen, is very heavily law-based. It relies very heavily and is very deeply entrenched in the Constitution. And I think the point that I would like to stress is that we see the Constitution as a very useful and helpful guide to government. It has been used probably more so as a way to challenge decisions of government, to challenge the failure of government, whether at national, provincial, or local level, local sphere, to act. But the flip side of that, I think, is often missed, and that is that the Constitution provides a very clear way of thinking through many issues. And that is why we have highlighted a number of key Constitutional Court decisions that we think provide the state with great guidance as to how to take forward the issue of planning. And that is where our critique of the Green Paper starts from. So let me first go to the Eight Law Project as an organization, very briefly explain how we have evolved over the last 16 years to lead to why we are making the submission. We were established in 1993 as a project of the Center for Applied Legal Studies at the University of Witwatersrand, the University in Johannesburg, initially set up by then Professor and now Justice Edwin Cameron. And the idea at that point in 1993, at the height of the constitutional negotiations and prior to the establishment of democracy, was to develop to develop the law in a way that would defend and advance the rights of people living with HIV. As that legal framework has developed over the years, and I think we are at the point where internationally South Africa is well respected for probably having the most comprehensive legal framework when it comes to the rights of people living with HIV, as that framework has been put in place, as the epidemic has matured, no longer simply an HIV epidemic, but both an HIV and an AIDS epidemic, as the science has changed, so too our work has changed over the years. linked to that, we have learned that by focusing narrowly on the issues that took our time, took much of our time in the early days, we can only go so far and not much further in advancing the broader ends of the organization. And that is that increasingly issues of the rule of law, accountability, governance, strategic planning have come to the fore. And that is why, for us, making an input into this process, and particularly looking at some of the constitutional angles that the Green Paper alludes to, for us is very important. The issues that we raise in our submission really can be grouped into five different issues. Firstly, it's what the Constitution has to offer, and in particular the jurisprudence of the Constitutional Court, when it comes to looking at the relationship between short, medium, and long-term planning. And the point that we make strongly is that we don't necessarily like the terminology and the concept of trade-offs. We think it is much more about thinking about an appropriate balance between short, medium, and long-term planning. The second point is around consultation, and I'll come to that in greater detail. The third is about and understandably what one would expect from an organization like ours, a concern that the issue of health planning doesn't feature very prominently, and the implications that then would have for the structure of the National Planning Commission as well as its focus. The fourth issue is an issue about institutional arrangements and the structure of the NPC itself. And then finally, a point which I'm not going to come back to, a point which I'm sure will be debated at great length tomorrow, and that is the relationship between the National Planning Commission and the Planning Ministry on the one hand, and other government departments, in particular the Economic Development Department on the other. It's something that I'm not going to go into today. The three points that I want to focus on are trade-off, consultation, and structure. I think probably the best starting point would be the Constitutional Court judgment in the Kurtzberg case. And an argument that has been made quite strongly by the state in that case, and that is that the provision of housing for people in desperate need would detract significantly from integrated housing development. And if one goes to the Green Paper, there's a quote that we pull out, and that talks about a long-term perspective to frame shorter-term trade-offs. And our reading of the judgment is that is precisely what the Constitutional Court says the Constitution does not permit government to do, and that is to sacrifice shorter-term needs in the name of medium and long-term planning. And perhaps just a short quote, I think, is important, the one I'd like to highlight from the judgment of Justice Yakub. Those whose needs are the most urgent and whose ability to enjoy all rights therefore is most imperiled must not be ignored by the measures aimed at achieving realization of the rights. It may not be sufficient to meet the test of reasonableness to show that the measures are capable of achieving a statistical advance in the realization of the rights. Furthermore, the Constitution requires that everyone must be treated with care and concern. If the measures, though statistically successful, fail to respond to the needs of those most desperate, they may not pass the test. So really just, a way of thinking through how one looks at short-term needs and makes some very difficult decisions as to how one achieves that proper balance between short, medium, and long-term. Obviously, not something that is going to differ from sector to sector, from issue to issue. But the language of the Green Paper does seem to suggest that short-term needs may well be sacrificed in the name of long-term planning. The second key issue I want to come to is the issue of consultation. And once again, we've pointed to a Constitutional Court judgment, the judgment in the case of Dr. for Life International, the Speaker of the National Assembly, and there's the majority judgment of now Chief Justice Ngogo. In that case, speaking very much about the parliamentary process, the lawmaking process, but making some very important points about what the Constitution requires when it speaks about consultation, and more importantly, on this issue, the value of consultation. And our understanding is that where the Green Paper speaks to consultation, it is much stronger on elements of consensus building and stakeholder recognizing the intrinsic value of consultation of stakeholders, and the not only because consultation may well bring legitimacy to the final product that develops after that, but that stakeholders themselves have substantive input to make in the process. Perhaps it's a question of semantics, but certainly the language of the Green Paper suggests that it is much more a question of buy-in than actually being very open to the input that stakeholders may well bring to the process. We recognize that that consultation is merely consultation. This is not, we have elected representatives. Ultimately, any decisions that are taken as a result of the National Planning Commission's work will be decisions that will be taken by Cabinet as a collective under the leadership of the President, and that we are not suggesting that that stakeholders should be able to veto such decisions, and that consultation necessarily means having to take on board everything that stakeholders bring to the process. But certainly it's being able to engage appropriately and where necessary to take those decisions to say we don't agree with you for these reasons and then to move forward. But a language that speaks to stakeholder buy-in speaks much more about the kinds of processes that the Green Paper seems to be guarding against. So this is not supposed to be about negotiation, not supposed to be about the lowest common denominator, and yet the approach to consultation seems to suggest that very problem. Finally, we want to come to the issue to raise is the issue of the structure of the National Planning Commission. I think here there are two very clear choices that government faces. Either government must go the route of an advisory panel that is merely that, a selection of experts that the presidency or the president or the minister in the presidency responsible for national planning consults for strategic direction, or an independent national planning commission set up in terms of an act of parliament which is able to operate independently, and by independently often got into trouble in parliament by raising the point. We do not mean outside of government, we're talking about an independent statutory body that is free from both political and commercial interference. The Green Paper seems to suggest some kind of hybrid body, a body that has the appearance of an independent structure, and yet when one looks at the detail, the little detail that is there in the Green Paper, it is clearly not an independent structure. So the Commission itself is led by the Minister, who chairs over a group of part-time commissioners. Commissioners are appointed by the President. We don't know according to what process, but certainly the Green Paper does not suggest any kind of process, whether or not a public appointment process. And here, when I talk about a public appointment process, what we have in mind is a process of public nominations, candidates being interviewed in public by the relevant committee, in the case of probably this committee in Parliament, and then on the recommendation of the committee, appointments are made by the President. That is the kind of process we are talking about. Three other points in terms that undermine the Commission's independence. Firstly, is the issue of coming back to the issue of public consultation. The Green Paper makes it clear that consultation will not be is not something that will be conducted by the commissioners themselves, but rather that will be by the minister himself or herself on behalf of the National Planning Commission. There's very little in the Green Paper about Parliament's role in relation to the work of the Planning Commission, and that role does seem to be mediated as well by the minister. And then finally, I think it may appear as a very technical point, but certainly from my experience with a range of other statutory bodies, including, again, speaking of my personal capacity, a statutory council that I sit on myself, that does not have control over its own secretariat. And that is quite problematic when one cannot rely on the goodwill of people who maybe currently are working within that particular unit in the presidency. If, as a commission, you do not have control over your own staff, you're not able to hire and fire your own staff, they're not directly accountable to you. It sets up a tension between commissioners and secretariat that is unsustainable. I think I'll leave it there. I think I've made the key points quite open to any questions that committee members may have. Thank you.
That interesting presentation, I'm sure, for the Simone Mahen. Honorable Monji Mugulele, followed by Steve. Honorable Kwa. Namchwana, if you end up. Okay. Honorable Mawaso and Honorable Batu. In that order. I hope you still remember. Over to you. Monty, you are the first, followed by Honorable Swart, and then Myung Shuan.
I agree with the question. The presentation is interesting. Very interesting. I'm not sure when you talk about when you challenge and interrogate the exercise of trade-off between short and long term. From which perspective you come. I'm saying this because I'm sitting here deliberately thinking that I cannot imagine judges thinking illogical for the sake of being illogical. I just want to use an economic term like, you know, in economics, there's something called current expenditure, the capital expense. One of the restrictions in government is that you wouldn't spend on behalf of the present to bend the future, because it amounts to decimation of the nation. In other words, you wouldn't go and borrow to spend on the current expenses, but you go and borrow to spend for the future. There is an interdependence, and that's what I'm telling you. There's an interdependence between short and long term. I thought there are instances where the essential address to short term has to be balanced with the long term. If I listen to you, you create an impression that there are no such instances. Just give one loud example. That if you look at meat, for instance, the meat remains meat whether you cook it or you don't cook it. But there are conditions where you must cook it in order to create particular germs. If someone wants to eat it now because it can be eaten, irrespective of whether they are there, not wanting to give up to the long term cooking so that you eat it without chance. I'm not trying to throw some analogies. I want you to come up and explain why this hard life is true to the principle of trade-off. The other issue is. The other issue is this lowest common denominator. It's not far away from chaos. Society, what keeps us together is what we see here. There are minimum rules that keeps us together. Even when you want to survive, there are those things that minimum must be there in order for you to survive. You seem to dismiss that logic. I do not understand on what basis do you dismiss it. Because, for instance, let's talk about HIV positive people. If you were to attend to all their needs, when some of them depend on the particular minimum health of society, there's an instance where if you take everything to them at the expense of the broader environment, that keeps them on top of water. You would actually not be helping them, you would be destroying them, actually shortening their life. I want you to actually elaborate more on this. Why this hardline opposition on the issue of prayer?
Thank you, Chair, and Jonathan, Mr. Berger, it's nice to see you again, and our commendations on the exceptional work that the ACL project does, and please pass on our best wishes to them. And thank you for your input and for highlighting the omission of the constitutional jurisprudence, and I think that's an issue that we definitely need to look at when we draft our report. That's firstly. Secondly, the omission of health planning is a serious omission, and we need to look at that as well. And the inclusion of a health expert on the planning commission is something that I definitely support that, and I think that it's an issue that we as an ad hoc committee need to look at very carefully. Mm-hmm. The issue that I'd like you to just comment on is your role, as you see the role of Parliament. Hugely important for us, because that's probably institutionally an issue that we're really grappling with. We're an ad hoc committee. Our tenure could come to an end, but we definitely would see it as a longer term. And it is where you say it seems that our role is limited to that to be mediated by a minister. Maybe you could just clarify as to how you would like to see Parliament's role. Clearly we've got a constitutional oversight role, that's Parliament's term. But we will be grappling with the issue to a longer term parliamentary committee that would exercise specific oversight. In view of shortcomings that you've probably experienced in the past of parliamentary oversight, and whether one needs a more focused parliamentary committee to look at oversight, and I'd like your comments on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. I would like to thank the President that he talked about something very important.
These facilities that you are not for record purposes. And for the purposes of recording, we'll start from the beginning.
Thank you. I was so curious. I had done something very wrong. Thank you. Thank you. I want to thank the presenter fully, Chairperson, because if government is deciding to plan and the community out there is invited to participate and nobody came, for such a planning will be futile. So thanks that we have people who have taken a serious thing and planning to come and present it. And I just want to comment on the fact that when you started, you explained that you are restricting to you, like you are not for profit. And we know that, of course, you are not for profit. But I think I've noticed over the years that because this AIDS pandemic issue has become so large, there are some, I don't know whether I would say some institutions that have got connections, connections that are not necessarily known by government. People who have heard about the plight of AIDS, especially in South Africa, and they are assisting, such that some income is being generated into those without making your knowledge. I want to check what we can do as we plan as government to make sure that there is no one who is participating here who is getting some assistance outside or inside the country. That may change this notion of the project being a non-profit project. I don't know if it makes sense, but I've noted that there are people who have really supported from outside, and they don't support veterans, they help financially. And if we can get maybe disclosures as we declare, so that we know what we are dealing with. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the chair. So, well, my first point has been well covered by colleague Gumbele, because I thought that the aspirin alpha is a balance, so I won't expand. But I just wanted to focus in one area where I think we are being, or the paper is being misunderstood. The very intention of the paper, the green paper, is to invite groups that seek to improve it. And the intention is very sincere. If, as you go through the areas, you think the government have missed a certain area or have not asked a certain critical question, you know, you are quite welcome to ask that question and also to give an answer to the same question. So that's the area where I'm coming in, where you were emphasizing that under consultation, that you get the impression that the government is not open to all, you know, input that may improve the paper. So I just want to think, to suggest and to indicate that the floor is yours, hence the consultation. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I also want to appreciate the input by Jonathan Berger, because I think that we resisted the temptation to battle for the lens of planning, which sector against which sector, but I think try to engage in the structures and the intentions of it. But I think that the one thing that I think we're struggling with is this issue of short-termism. In fact, I think we're trying to overcome short-termism, because I think that we've had a situation where resources were shifting from area to area based on what occasion. So when Grootboom happened, suddenly the Western Cape housing budget shifted up to 1 billion. Not that it solved the problem, but we suddenly took a lot of money from somewhere else and put it in there in order to respond. When the ruling came on ARVs, we shifted money in order to try and get universal antiretroviral treatment out to people. I think that there was a time in El Nino, which was a forerunner to climate change, happened, and suddenly a whole lot of resources went into mitigating El Nino. And so what you had was a state that was responsive to a whole lot of different issues, whether from the courts, whether from this whatever, and it could never anchor a path towards the future. And so I think the point around short-termism that we're trying to do is, how do we make the short-term in the image of the long-term? Where do we want to be 15 years from now, and how do we work our way back on issues like HIV, on issues like climate change, on issues like job creation, this, that, and the other. So I thought maybe just to counterpose, rather than work from a court ruling out, can we work from a future scenario, long term, down, backwards, to make those kind of things? So that's the first thing that I thought would need to be resolved, because that's the core of the green paper. The other thing is on the issue of consultation, how broad and so forth. I think reading the green paper starts with the process of competing manifestos from different parties and the electorate speaks. Then it says that from that, the ruling party developed a mandate. The mandate is turned into a state of the nation address. It's presented to Parliament and accepted. Now, I think that where the green paper comes in, isn't in any of those, the green paper doesn't determine the manifesto, the mandate, or the state of the nation necessarily. It says once you've got that, how do we have an instrument of the executive to make it rational, intelligent, and capable of moving forward? Now, I think that you are now down to consultation, not on the primary issues. You are on the consultation of managing, because on any given day you won't have enough money, human resources, expertise, and so forth to deal with a myriad of needs. But to make that instrument a far more intelligent one. So I think that there is lots of consultation, lots of interaction, but it is interaction towards achieving a particular set of goals. And so I thought that maybe just to problematize the two key things, and then I think that there's very valuable stuff. How do you appoint the commissioners? The Green Paper is silent on it. The role of Parliament. But if you look at it in terms of this being an executive instrument, maybe we should find a way in which oversight doesn't necessarily give Parliament responsibility over executive issues. But maybe is that, and then I think that how do you also draw the clear lines? Those are between different departments, and make sure that we can get a synergy rather than a competitive instinct developed there. But I thought that I just wanted to counterpose the two very crucial questions that I think that you did challenge us with.
Over to you. Thank you, Chair. I thought I was going to have an easy run. I was trying to stay. very interesting questions, very difficult questions, and I'll do my best to answer them. First question, Honourable Gungubele. I think we're probably not very far apart on what we're both saying. I think the primary concern that we raised was maybe not so much the term trade-off, but that what we read in the Green Paper was almost a trade-off of short-term goals in the name of longer-term planning, as opposed to finding that appropriate balance between short, medium, and long-term. I think a lot of what has been said by various members in relation to achieving that appropriate balance, I certainly agree with, and organizations would agree with. But I think what it does raise, and I think it comes to another question you asked me, was from which perspective am I coming? And I come from an organization that works very much with matters of life and death. And for us, many of the, when we hear about long-term planning issues, sometimes it raises the question of, well, the people whose interests we advance, are they going to live long enough to be able to enjoy the fruits of the long-term planning? And I think that for us, it is not meant as a flippant comment, but I remember during the hearings in the Khurupur case, when the state lawyers were making the argument about in the long term everyone will have a house, and the Chief Justice at the time, Justice Chaplin, said in the long term we'll all be dead. And I think that is the concern that we bring to this. It's not a concern to say we are not suggesting that we throw all our money at short-term goals and that there isn't a project plan. We strongly support both the existence of a National Planning Commission and the rationale underpinning and the need for national strategic planning. Our concern is that we don't sacrifice some very immediate short-term emergency needs in the name of long-term planning. I can't really say much more than that. I don't think we're very far apart on that issue. And yes, I do agree there is an interdependence between the short, medium, and long-term goals. The issue about the lowest common denominator and the minimum rules that keep us together, the point we tried to make in our submission was that we believe the Constitution itself provides the basis for that. It provides the rules, the values that bring us together as a country. And certainly we're not suggesting that anything to the contrary. The issue of low common denominator was precisely in the context of consultation. And it was to say that, and maybe this comes to a point that Honourable Rasool raised at the end, I can bring it in here. For us, consultation, it's not necessarily about the extent of consultation. We certainly are not suggesting that the entire process be reopened. There, a ruling party is elected into government with a particular mandate, with its democratic mandate, and it has to implement that mandate. There is no disagreement with that. What we are saying is that the nature of the consultation, the manner in which consultation takes place, is something that is of concern to us, and that one, it's not
government, but the approach that seems to be suggested in the Green Paper is one of trying to get buy-in rather than to say what expertise, what experience is there out there that can assist us in government in making these decisions. Because ultimately these are decisions that government has to take. They're not decisions that are going to be put out in a referendum, certainly where they may well become relevant as the country goes to election. Honourable Swati, you raised the issue of the role of Parliament. We haven't really thought about the exact nature, whether it should be a joint monitoring committee or committee both in the National Assembly and in the NTSP. Certainly the idea of a, and it's something that the Green Paper itself does talk about, of a committee in Parliament to which the Minister and the Presidency would report, I think is something that we do support. As a more immediate issue, we believe that Parliament has a very strong role to play in the appointment process, we've mentioned that. And secondly, in engagement with commissioners themselves, our reading of the Green Paper is that the engagement would take place through the Minister as opposed to engagement directly with commissioners, and we think that would be problematic, and in fact it should be both. It's not, the oversight role is not a heavy-handed approach that looks at trying to find fault with what has taken place. It is about trying to understand why certain decisions have been taken and trying to engage with the methodology, with the processes that have been taking place. And we feel that by excluding commissioners from that process, Parliament would not be able to kind of to bring the rich role that it potentially can play. Then on to the question of Honourable Mashwana, I'm not sure if I understood your question correctly. If it goes to who are we and how are we funded, I'm quite glad to answer that question, where our sources of funding come from, and if that is the concern.
I think it's more of a comment.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think so. Than a question.
Then if I can move on to Honourable Mabasa's question, first comment on the intention of the Green Paper to invite comments and to improve on it. That is certainly the spirit with which we have engaged with the Green Paper. We've certainly not suggested that this is understood that this is cast in stone, and that this is the reason why one publishes the Green Paper for comments is precisely to be able to feed on it in the policy development process as it goes forward. What we have raised are our concerns in relation to the thinking that is underpinning this Green Paper. And so a lot of thinking has gone into that, and we've tried to understand where the thinking is coming from, and in our view, how that squares with our understanding of a range of issues already addressed by our constitutional court, whether it's an issue of planning or the issue of consultation. And so that we have tried to engage with the thinking, hopefully with the intention of improving as the process goes forward, and we could go forward to a white paper, ultimately to some form of legislation. The final question is raised by Honourable Rasool. I think the one point that I would like to raise is that I think the history of litigation and the history of these very difficult questions being resolved by courts does point to the very problem that I think the Green Paper is trying to address. And had there been the kind of planning process that the Green Paper envisages, firstly, some of those cases may well have not, the need for those for that litigation may not have arisen. And secondly, they, had it arisen, the issues would have been much narrower. And I think what we've seen in more recent constitutional court jurisprudence, for example, in the Matabuka case dealing with the prepaid water meters in Piri and Soweto, we've seen that where a government, in this case local government, has been able to explain to a court the manner in which it has engaged in planning, the evidence upon which it's based its decision, that the courts are going to be very reluctant to intervene. Some of my colleagues, not in my own organization, but in other organizations, are very angry at that decision. I think it probably does strike an appropriate balance between the role that courts are supposed to play. But I think it is a very strong lesson in how one can avert the kinds of problems that Honorable Sula was speaking about if one has a planning process that works properly. And ultimately, I think some of us who are lawyers may well not enjoy the thrill of the courtroom any longer, but certainly as a way of resolving critical problems facing the country, we don't want to have to resolve them through the courts. And hopefully the kind of National Planning Commission that I think all of us would like to see, and the kind of process it's developing would avert those kinds of problems. I think there's one final point, and that comes back to the question of Parliament's role. I think Parliament, whatever structure is ultimately agreed upon, whichever manner in which national planning takes place, whether it's through an independent planning commission, whether it's a much stronger role, whether it's directly done internally within the presidency itself, and then reflecting by way of a panel of experts, Parliament will always be called upon by the Constitution to exercise that role. And coming back to the earlier point, I think it's important that we don't see oversight merely as a stick to try and punish a department that's not doing its work, but that we see it more as a way in which the various arms of government engage with each other and debate with each other. And for me, I think that's important, that if matters are left solely within the executive or solely within the judiciary or parliament, the richness that we get from the different branches of government interacting with each other is lost. And so, in moving forward, whatever process, whatever document comes beyond the Green Paper, I'd certainly like to see much more for what kind of a role is envisaged for Parliament in a way that's respectful of and gives space to the executive to do its job, but at the same time keeps the executive on its toes and is able to engage the executive in a way that no other arm of government is able to do.
Thank you, Jonathan. I think you have responded to most of the issues, if not all, the questions of clarity that the members pose, but also the sort of input that is to go into the Green Paper itself. From where we are sitting also, we think your introductory input or to your input was very, very, very much positive in the sense that it is an acknowledgement that as a country, we are probably one of the leading nations in the world in terms of our response and the comprehensive plan that we have towards fighting the pandemic, and that is the policy of the HIV AIDS in our country. Secondly, I think you have also touched on the importance of the meaning, the spirit of consultation, that this committee should be alive at all times. So that consultation does not just become one of those buzzwords that we have to conform to, but it must be meaningful at the end of the day.
And also to say your understanding as an organization, the conditions that you represent, consultation does not mean concurrent at all costs. Everything that has been said and discussed, therefore, must go into the current paper or anywhere else. In terms of short-term and medium-term and long-term issues, I think from a constituency-based point of view, it is quite clear that as an organization, the people you represent, from time to time, you are very, very much alive to the issue that might change the problems that you have in place and the problems that government has been supporting in the past years, and therefore there should be a balance at all times between short-term and long-term goals. And I think in that spirit also, I think as a way of encouraging our people and living positively, long-term has also entailed a perspective that says, if you live with HIV/AIDS, your problems cannot be short-term or medium-term. You are part of the future. I think it's very, very important. So that psychologically the mindset is always geared towards being part of society and not to be part of the society up to a particular point. The other point that you've raised is in terms of structural relationships with the document. I think which is quite critical for members of the committee to look into as we move forward. And you have raised an important point. One, the green paper and researches a planning commission, but it's not very clear whether it's a statutory body or an advisory body. This is the question that is posed to us. In your view, it devils in between. It's a quasi structure that the green paper is talking about from your own analysis. As an organization, and I think we'll take that point as a committee, as a point that needs to be teased further in terms of our deliberation. And also, your touch on the issue of the processes of appointing commissioners, where does it start and where does it end? What is the role of Parliament? I think it's a point that has been raised, the honourable members, that we should but finally, the role of Parliament itself, I think it's quite critical that the members are looking at that. So I thought these are, in the main, salient points of your presentation, from the document that I went through it, and also from your own presentation today. And I think that captures everything that you wanted to share with us this morning, or this afternoon, by the way. Thank you very much. I think we'll not take a short break. You are welcome to remain behind and take and be part of us in terms of taking other presentations. Jerry, Musa, and Camera of Mind are the next presenters. Are you ready? We don't have those gadgets today with PowerPoint presentations and all that. I know Musa is very, very much into those things. That we can do without them for today. Thank you. If honourable members agree that we should move in that direction, I proceed. Okay, good. You choose who starts first. You indicate to us. You are all business. Chamber of Mines and Busa.
Thank you, Chair. If I could open on behalf of Busa, firstly by expressing our appreciation to the committee for the opportunity of presenting here this afternoon. Also, should that mention that we did submit a preliminary document, but we have a final written submission which I believe has been circulated to you this afternoon, and it is to that document that I will be speaking and lifting out some of the main points of that submission. And I think both from our preliminary document and our final document, we see that Luther welcomes the broad approach of the Green Paper and some of the objectives that have been identified in the Green Paper. And we accept also that if we look internationally, there are other examples of planning commissions and planning structures, some of which have worked better than others. but which we in turn need to relate ultimately to our own experiences in South Africa. So although the global experience is helpful and there are some lessons to be learned, we also need in deciding what planning mechanism we would like in the future to critically evaluate some of the past overarching policy factors and initiatives that we have employed, such as the RDP, ACFISA, GIPSA, the EPWP, the Presidential Development Node, Project Consolidate. What are some of the lessons that can inform us as we move forward to create a new and better planning structure? One of the points that did occur to us when we reviewed some of these initiatives were that some of them were ad hoc. They were underpinned by structures that were established by an executive decree rather than by legislation, point to which we will return. So from the Booster perspective, Chair, the reconfiguration of planning and coordination to be guided by the appropriately established institutions perhaps are even more important now for South Africa against the background of the current global economic crisis. And the challenges we face quite clearly do require a long-term vision supported by proper planning in order to address these socio-economic challenges. So we are anxious to engage in a positive way with the structures and the processes around future planning as outlined in the Green Paper. What we thought might be helpful is to perhaps indicate and outline from the Booster point of view that to make a success of what one might call a high road for future planning, what are some of the conditions for us being successful in this field, more successful than we've been in the past? And we have identified 8 conditions for more rational planning in future. And the first one, which is outlined in the document, is that there has to be a clear and proper process of establishing the planning structure. This is absolutely crucial. So right up front, we are suggesting that the presidency should eventually respond to the submissions that have been made, that a white paper should follow on these discussions, which clearly are dealing with proposals which are not cast in stone, and that legislation should underpin whatever new structures are agreed to, and that oversight structures should also be created in Parliament and elsewhere. In other words, we see a statutory framework as also perhaps providing for a standing committee of Parliament on planning, monitoring, and evaluation, and that this legislative framework and indeed the oversight structures would provide for the necessary clarity and certainty as to its status. The second condition, which we identified as being helpful, is that as has been pointed out by the Green Paper, the proposed National Planning Commission does not make policy, but supports its formulation and its formation, and helps to plan and coordinate its execution. And here we suggest that we should look very carefully at the role of the cabinet clusters on the one hand, and the suggestion that a ministry, at least a ministerial committee on planning, should be created. There seems to us that there could be some conflict there that needs to be resolved for the future. The third condition is the issue of the status and the credibility of the Planning Commission, and you've already heard some of the inputs here this afternoon. We certainly think that it should be an independent structure, but nonetheless a structure which is able to make real inputs based on not only knowledge but experience drawn from some of the stakeholders in our society. So we think there ought to be some attention given to the possibility of a blend of representativity and expertise, even though those who might be appointed in those slots would be appointed in their personal capacity. What's important here from a Booster point of view is that we would like the Planning Commission to be able to offer the best advice possible and also to be so structured that it builds confidence in its process and in its operation. And quite clearly, from the Green Paper, we do not yet have clarity as to how that might be done. The fourth condition is the issue of capacity across government to make this planning and implementation possible. And given the skills shortage which the country faced, we simply make the point that we should try to use existing structures where they can be strengthened instead of perhaps creating new ones where they might not be needed. For example, the PCAS might be strengthened instead of having a separate secretariat for the proposed APC. Chair, the fifth condition is simply, I think, to remind ourselves that there are a number of planning tools that already exist, and that we would hope that the MPC, in order to be a successful structure, will make use of all those tools, including the RIAs, regulatory assessment impact studies, which have been started by government and which are an important instrument of planning for the future. The sixth condition is, once again, I think this has been referred to in some of the other submissions. It is not as if we're starting with a clean sheet of paper. There are other structures that need to be integrated or at least aligned with what the MPC will do. For example, if we take the role of NEDLAC, we need to make quite sure that we indeed have got coordination and not duplication as between those various structures. The seventh condition is just a reminder that we live in a mixed economy, with the private sector and the public sector working together. And that is very important in the whole planning process to strike a right balance between the cooperation between the public sector and the private sector in order to make the mixed economy work better in future and to deliver better outcomes. And public-private sector partnerships, for example, are one tool that it can use. The eighth condition and the final condition, Chair, is really that we need to set very realistic parameters for the Planning Commission and apply strict reality tests of what will work very successfully going beyond the structures that we have now. And here we think that this role needs to be revisited in the sense that we need to ask ourselves some very important questions about what would work best in terms of the proposed National Planning Commission. I think as some of the other submissions have said, we believe that the Planning Commission is going to serve a very valuable purpose, can add great value to our decision making. It's not a panacea, it's not a magic wand, as indeed some other countries have found. What's important is that it is backed by a shared vision, and that we structure it, Chair, in such a way that it provides as much certainty and predictability for decision makers in both the public and the private sectors as we can achieve. So our conclusion from looking at those conditions, Chair, is very much that we think that this debate now needs to be taken to the next level, which is after your committee has had its discussions We would like to see feedback and response from the presidency to the various issues that have been raised. That this process really perhaps ought to be taken to the next level with a white paper, which will spell out in greater detail and respond to many of the questions that have been raised. And that finally, we think that it would be appropriate if the ultimate form of what we are proposing to do was enshrined in legislation. There are a number of advantages to that, and we think that's perhaps something which the committee could bear in mind in arriving at its conclusions on the way ahead. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I can't remember whether you introduced yourself at the beginning, but I know you are ready to start. If you did not, then honorable member. Yeah. Am I right?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. And if we could ask the same of mine, especially now, as part two.
Thank you. Okay. How about you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Franz Barker, senior executive from the Chamber of Mines. First of all, apologies from the CEO of the Chamber, Mr. Delisa, and also the president of the Chamber, Mr. Corsi. The invitation was made at very short notice, and they were unfortunately unable to change their diaries in order to be able to attend here this morning, this afternoon. I would also like to change the order of our presentation, and I would really like to deal with three issues this afternoon. The first of all, the first issue is the nature of planning. I'd like to say something about that. Secondly, I'd like to deal with the National Planning Commission itself. And then thirdly, make some specific remarks about the mining industry. Then also, I should also add that the Chamber supports the Busa inputs. We were also part of the Busa inputs, but we also have certain perspectives that we would also like to bring to the committee's attention. As Busa has indicated, we as business, we support, very strongly support the idea of national strategic planning. I think Honourable Member Rasool has said that very eloquently, to anchor a path into the future and to get away from the short-termism that one sometimes find if one doesn't look at long-term planning, at the importance, where do we want to take the country. The problem also is one doesn't have a coordinated planning approach, is that many delivery issues, and the country is struggling with many delivery issues, as the mining industry is also itself struggling with delivery issues. Many of those issues need multi-inputs that need to be coordinated from different departments, different stakeholders, and strategic planning can play a very important role there. Also, there are often contradictory policies, and one needs to look at a proper planning approach in order to make sure that you take the country in a certain direction, and these contradictory policies don't really contradict each other, but you can really have an integrated approach. And of course, there are often unintended consequences of policies that you also can address if you look at the policies in a structured way. Part of the problem with planning is, of course, also to achieve the right balance between various factors, and the Green Paper also refers to some international examples of planning which simply didn't work. So planning isn't always the final solution, and one must get the right balance between planning and also, for instance, in our case, coming from business, market forces. One needs to look at that as well, that one gets the right balance between those two, because if you try in detail to plan everything and your plan is wrong, then you might be causing more problems and negative consequences for the economy. So getting that balance is quite difficult. The other issue with regard to planning, the process of planning and nature of planning, is that it's very important that you should get broad support for the planning outcomes. The Green Paper refers to an inclusive approach and broad support and so on, but the question is whether the Green Paper approach will actually achieve that. In our view, it will not. We don't think that the process outlined in the Green Paper will achieve that broad consensus and support for policy. We agree that independent experts should play a key role. That we do agree with that. But what are the roles of the other stakeholders? In our case, we'd like to refer to the stakeholders of business and labor. And it seems that if they are simply going to be consulted along the way, but not by the Commission. And we think that is a shortcoming that this ad hoc committee can perhaps consider if it agrees with us. Is there not some other way in which the inputs can be obtained? We think one of the roles might be to get some of the commissioners, but the minority perhaps, of the commissioners from business and from labor, but get them in their personal capacity, but also the independent experts should still play the key role in those commissions. Otherwise, it simply becomes a negotiating body, and then you might again have the short-termism that several honourable members refer to. So we don't want a negotiating body, but we also want stakeholders to be involved. Another method might be to get subcommittees of the NPC to look at specific issues, and there you could have experts involved or representatives involved from stakeholders. And an issue that has been referred to quite often, with which we fully agree, is the process of appointing the commissioners is absolutely critical. And there I think Parliament can play a very important role to make sure that the right commissioners are appointed, but also that part of the process of getting broad support is in following the right process when it comes to the commissioners. The final issue with regard to this first point, and the first point I might remind you is the nature of planning, is the links between planning and the monitoring of the implementation of policies. We think that this should be a two-way process. Once the planning has been done and implemented, then there should be some loop, some feedback back into the plan, because one might find that unintended consequences, or it's impossible to implement, or for whatever reason the plan isn't proper, it doesn't work as well as it should, then there should be a loop back into the plan so that the plan can be revised. But without introducing short-termism and deviating markedly from the plan in the short term, but I think there are, it is important that one should also have that feedback from the monitoring back into the plan. That is the first topic, thank you. Then the second topic is the National Planning Commission itself. And the first issue is, what is actually the authority of the National Planning Commission? Bruce said it is an advisory body. We fully support that. We think it can be an advisory body with a statutory basis as well. We don't think that the two necessarily exclude each other, but it's something that this ad hoc committee can consider. But we think it must be an advisory body. You can't have anything more than an advisory body, especially if individual experts are involved. So the final decision needs to be made by Cabinet and ultimately by Parliament. But the question is, what is it going to plan? Is it going to plan implementation of policy, or is it going to plan the policy? Well, yes, it is going to plan the implementation of policy, but we think it should also plan the coordination of policy, as it were. I think the Green Paper refers to policy coherence. So I think even when the policy has been determined broadly by government or by the ANC or by wherever those policies are determined, this body can play an important role able to make sure that the policies are coherent and that they are coordinated. And then, obviously, it goes to cabinet for ultimate approval. So it can really only influence the policy decisions of the executive. So what can it not do? It cannot make policy decisions. That is quite clear. It cannot micro-plan. The departments must continue to make their own plans, and those plans will obviously go to cabinet, but they could also go to the National Planning Commission, so that the Planning Commission can work on the coherence of the plans and then present plans for the country as a whole. It cannot micromanage. The document also refers to spatial planning. In our view, the Commission is going to be so busy with these other issues that it will not be able to get around to doing spatial planning as well. That is simply going to be too difficult. An issue that the Eighth Law Project reminded me, I was involved in both the statutory body, which was advisory, and the statutory negotiating body in both of those, and it's critical that it should control its own staff. I think that they made a very good point in that regard. It's also something that this ad hoc committee could also consider, that it controls its own staff. The other issue is that regarding the NPC is that it's not an island. It shouldn't sit there in some ivory tower and think of grand plans, and nobody at the end of the day gives any attention to those plans. It's critical that there should be the necessary interaction. I've already referred to the interaction with business and labor, with other stakeholders and so on. I've already referred to that. But it should also interact with negotiating bodies such as NEDLAC. On a regular, structured basis, there should be meetings between this NPC and NEDLAC. I think even with regard to Parliament, if Parliament is going to create perhaps an oversight body responsible for planning issues, then as the NPC is developing a plan, it can also interact with Parliament to find out what the views are with Parliament before it presents a final plan to a cabinet and to Parliament. Also, with regard to this issue, I think it is also important that it also gets departmental plans. Not to detail those plans, not at all, but to make sure that there's policy coherence with regard to the plans. Those plans also go to cabinet, and the cabinet approves the implementation. But it must also make sure that the plans are coherent in this broad national planning of the NPC. Then also finally under this point is a ministerial committee on planning has been proposed. And we just in the chamber are concerned that this might again encourage it, or it might not reduce its role as an ivory tower that does some planning. There are ministerial clusters, and one wonders if they, as Bruce has also indicated, if they are not a better vehicle for the inputs to go to. And it depends also which input, if it's an health issue, health or human resources, it can go to the relevant cluster. That is my second point. The third and final point is, as far as mining is concerned, that I'll be very brief. The mining industry at the moment is at a crossroads. We have looked at the performance of the mining industry over the past number of years, and the industry is lagging behind other mining countries. It is not contributing to the economy of the country as it should. Also, the benefits of mining is not always spread as widely as it should. And this is due to both controllable and uncontrollable factors. And we strongly believe, and it's all stakeholders in mining, including government, the relevant department and the unions, that the mining industry can contribute in a bigger way to the government's vision of reducing poverty, more equitable distribution of the benefits of mining, jobs, and so forth. The industry is already contributing to the economy. If we look at jobs, for instance, about 1 million jobs directly and indirectly. If we look at addressing the legacies of the past, the mining industry is still at the forefront of BEE deals. But unfortunately, there is also a problem with regard to these BEE deals. Some of them are under the water because of the commodity prices. They're not always as broad-based as they should be. So there are problems, yes, but it is still at the forefront of BEE deals. Strengthening the skills base of the economy, there's a lot that the industry does, and I'm not going to waste the committee's time. Sharing the benefits of the industry with the induced impact, in other words, the secondary impact of mining. The mining industry is the second biggest contributor to GDP after manufacturing, after the manufacturing sector. And if you look at the benefits of mining, it's only a tiny proportion of the benefits of mining that flow out of the country. The rest is spent in the country in terms of wages, procurement, taxes, whatever it might be. And then finally, supporting the development state, 22 billion rand is paid in terms of through tax, 20% of the tax revenue. Also, 50% of merchandise exports come from the mining industry, and 35% of the capital inflows in the country to support the deficit on the current account. So the mining industry does play a big role, but we feel it can play an even bigger role. And that is now where the mining industry could play a role with regard to the work of the National Planning Commission. What we have done is we have launched some time ago already a project, and it was not our initiative, it was the initiative of the Department of Mineral Resources, to develop a vision for the industry, a long-term plan, if I may call that, a strategic plan. And the government, it is under the leadership of the department, and the key stakeholders are involved. And we will be looking at two things. First of all, the global competitiveness of the industry, but secondly, the transformation of the industry. And including in that would be issues such as safety, which we have improved, but not enough. Some of the legacies in terms of the environment and so on that we will address. And we hope that the outcome of this process will be one of those inputs into the national strategic planning that we refer to. The departmental plans will feed into that plan, and then an overall plan will be developed. And we hope that this will then be one of those types of inputs, and perhaps the same can be done in respect of other core industries of the South African economy. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much, Frank. I think honourable members, it is our opportune moment to engage with the submissions from the Busa in the Chamber of Mines. Yeah, it doesn't matter how we start. Honourable is followed by Bungulele, Honourable Bungulele. I was wondering Honourable Singh why it's gone so quiet. It will be the third one. Shouldn't you agree with all the submissions? Okay. Trust.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the input. There's so much that you need to deal with, and thank you for the 8 factors from it, because I think they are very useful to deal with them to see to what degree one can include some of them. I'm just interested in your comments on the process as we look forward. We as a committee are placed under quite a degree of urgency to finalise this process, and I actually raised this issue of the white paper at the first meeting of the committee, whether there should be a green paper, white paper and a statutory. So coming from there seems to be merit in that suggestion. But there's also pressure from the executive to get this process going as quickly as possible. And I'd just like your comments as to how to marry the two sides almost. There's a deficiency of a strategic plan at the moment. We are concerned about it having been fleshed up properly in the role of parliament and institutions and that type of thing. And the failure of such planning commissions in certain other countries and the dangers of that, we need to look into that as well. So we are a little bit more hesitant, and but we're also under pressure to finalise something quickly. If one goes the route that you propose of the green paper, white paper, and statutory legislation, will that not delay the process for, in our experience, that could delay for 18 months, a year, longer? And can we wait that long? Balance against that is the need possibly to consider that as a process. And clearly these are some issues we're going to have to put in our report to the executive, and I'd like your comments as one balances those two sides. Thank you.
I think
speaking to the mic.
I thought I was doing that. Thank you, person. The green paper speaks of the Interministerial Planning Committee. You seem to, all of you, express reservations about its role versus the existence of clusters. I just want to be a devil's advocate a little bit on this matter, so that we can get more clarity from you. Because the interim, I assume if this were to be end up, if this were to end up in place, that this interministerial committee is not similar to clusters. Because clusters are established in terms of particular categories. It is social transformation, it is this. But interministerial committee would be looking at the overall political guidance in a more collective but in a sub-committee fashion. Why do you think this would be, in some of your words, would be probably duplicating clusters in what way? I'm just calling for more explanation of where is this concern based. The second issue is, I think both of you are also expressing concern about side by side existence of the need for dynamic relationships between planning and monitoring and what we call evaluation. I know probably a number of conventions that would actually say a planning should produce its own monitoring system. There are such conventions, but I'm interested to know from which perspective that they come. What I'm also interested in, you seem to be interestingly concurring on this one. Why this concern about the involvement of the NPC on special development? Because I thought you seem to be convinced that actually your contribution borders on saying stay away from this. But your contribution, it borders on saying that. But I'm saying, if we talk about central planning, coordinated planning, all the material issues that have got a bearing on us moving coherently and to achieve maximum, to ensure maximum achievement, should be taken into account. I thought you were going to say, if work is done, maybe the role then of the NPC would be to ensure that that is part of the productivity. But you seem to be a bit clearly saying, stay away from this. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know why.
because one of the critical things, Mr. Fassi, you will remember, is that it's not just an economic issue. It's an issue of ownership. It's an issue of space to ensure means of survival by the historically disadvantaged. Not just for the pure purpose of successful economic planning, but also to ensure that development and take into account transformation issues. So the point I'm saying is that I'm curious why both of you, you seem to be saying stay away from this. And the other issue is the NCC versus department to Mr. Baca. I think this debate, I do not know where is it actually placed or where does it come from. I'll explain. I understand what the Green Paper, what it seeks to do, is to say we need to a coordinated process of planning where the dynamic relationship between all the role players, but in a manner that ensures contribution again to the ultimate goal of the country. Now, coming in of the national planning is to say, make sure that it is central, but why central? Central is because there are many other people in national who will be planning. It's known that there will be departments, it's known that there will be Department of Health, Department of Economic Affairs. What is this worry of saying, please don't take the work of protocol of departments? Where is it bad? Because the point I'm trying to make here is that, don't you think there's a unique role for central planning vis-a-vis the key players who are being coordinated in this planning? What is the source of this fear about the planning taking the work of the department? Because its intention is to ensure that the work of the department is coordinated and it is efficiently exploited. It is itself here in the document. Departments must have capacity to plan. They must have capacity, they must have technical ability, organizational ability, so that mutual and complementary nature is coordinated towards and so that we achieve. Where is this sort of work that the work of the department will be taken on? Where is it based at?
Okay. I
would have said if I would have said that if I didn't say that your submission actually has made major contribution in my job and have actually taken us a leap higher than where that's my view.
Yeah, and that your concerns are not fear. Yeah. Honorable thing.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to pick up on the spatial development planning issue. And my sense, colleague Mondi, through you, Chair, is that I don't know, Mr. Barkett, you said that they need to stay away from spatial development planning issues, rather than you said they will be extremely busy to manage other planning issues, and that hence they should not deal with spatial development planning issues. But I think we are of the view here that the Planning Commission should deal with it, and we may have to find ways of ensuring that they deal with spatial development planning issues. I just need your comment on that. And secondly, I think you also, in passing, mentioned the monitoring and evaluation. Now, there was a green paper released as well on the monitoring and evaluation. And I'd like to know from both Bruce and Cameron Mine if you did make any comments on that, because public comments were invited. And to what extent those comments link with this, because for me, personally, there is a very strong relationship between the monitoring evaluation and the Planning Commission. And it's unfortunate, Chairperson, that there wasn't a process like this of an ad hoc committee to deal with both the papers. It just, we were confined only to the Green Paper on the Planning Commission. And maybe that's something that we need also pronounce on as we consider this matter. So it's like your comment.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think that both submissions help us enormously because it either makes suggestions or it asks questions, which I think helps this committee to think through things such as the authority of the planning advisory or statutory, whatever the case may be, the role of Parliament, the issues around the location of the secretariat and whose control, etc., etc. And I think that the 8 points generally all seem to help in that regard. And I think that maybe in terms of being helpful in that way on some of the micro details of the green paper, whether we are not seeing a little bit of an application on a very crucial level of contribution that could be made. I think that if one were to look at the AIDS law project, they came very definitely, they said that this is the lens that we work with. We deal with the issues of poverty, the issues of wellness, and we think that they should be strong. If you listen to Harold Winkler, he was saying our lens is unashamedly the climate change, and this has to shape fundamentally the way we plan into the future. And I wonder whether there's an application of a lens that we've heard from business and from mining particularly. In Trevor Manuel, when he addressed the committee, he said, everyone wants to go to heaven, but no one wants to die. Now, the point, its application here, is we've got to grasp the nettle. Sometimes in a range of planning mechanisms that you or things that you want to plan, there's one that you've got to, almost not one, but there's a series that you've got to sequence, and we've got to understand where does spatial planning come in either maintaining a status quo or subverting a status quo. And maybe the spatial planning is the domino that falls that begins to free up land for housing, issues of rural development, conservation, so that you don't have unwarranted development in places that should be your green lungs, for example. So maybe in terms of that, one needs to be able to understand not the busyness of the committee or of the planning commission, but the crucial nature of spatial planning within it. We've got to grasp the nettle, otherwise we abdicate a key planning mechanism that should be there. I think secondly, are we being over-deferential? And I'm not making a suggestion, I'm asking a question. Are we being over-deferential and over-considerate of the autonomy of departments and ministers and clusters to say, let's incorporate their plans. What's the tail and what is the dog? And who's wagging who? Is this not an intervention to correct what has gone wrong for 15 years? And should you be over-deferential and repeat some of the shortcomings? Or should we grasp the nettle and say, we only want to see departmental plans within the parameters of a long-term vision? So it's really just saying, let's be prepared to be glorious in the frankness with which we raise these issues. I think I would have expected that if mining comes to us and say that our performance is lagging, we're making a significant contribution, but our performance is lagging. I'm sure that the mining experts would have, and the geologists and so forth, would have a span into the future to say that, listen, you're going to see the best of us for the next few decades till year, there, the other. Are you planning beyond resources? Now, I mean, that is such a fundamental planning mechanism that you can't wait for government to suggest a long-term view of the future. You can't be one input. Just like the human crisis catastrophe is telling us that they're not just an input, they're fundamental. The environmental people are saying, no, because we're just not the input, we're fundamental. And I think here mining comes and gives us these figures and says we want to be an input. You can't.
the whole ambition that we have for employment, for economic growth, for balance between environment and development, and the wellness of our people, and reducing the poverty gaps and the inequality, depends on a bold assertion by business, more generally, to say, listen, we've looked at 20 years hence, and this is how we see the future. So that I think we must get some of the politeness, because Mr. Mann is apart from a polite person, and we've got to get some of the politeness out of the thing if we're going to make this thing work. I just thought that I had used this opportunity with business chairperson to be a bit more impolite in the things that I say.
I'm covered partly or mostly by the input around the requirement for a white paper process. I'd just like to specifically hear from Mr. Parsons and Mr. Barker exactly why, or categorically why there should be, why they believe there should be a white paper process propped up by legislation.
Mushwana, and then you'll be followed by Miyamati. You'll be the last that will allow them to
for the forum. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm taking the concerns that were raised, although many people spoke to them. I'm reading 3.3 from Business Unity South Africa. I'm reading their concerns specifically, where they say that the integrity and status of the proposed NPC are insatiable, and they go on to talk of the fact that they should not be elitist or remote and should not exclude those people there, including business and labor. Because when I read number 15 on page 23, unless if I'm reading wrong, I think the National Planning Commission there is said that to be the commission that will be respected, that will have respected thinkers, and it goes down to say that the commissioners should collectively have expertise and practical experience in areas such as business, finance, labor. My understanding was that it's like, unless if I'm not reading it correctly, so that I don't see why there should be any concern, because the proposal in the green, in this green paper, although from green paper, we need to move to white. Already, currently, no consent, but unless if I don't understand it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm also one of the members who welcomed the previous speaker from both presenters. I just want to get a clarity because the gentleman from the Chamber of Mines talked about the controllable and uncontrollable. I didn't hear it clearly whether he was speaking about the benefits based on the controllable and uncontrollable. What he was also mentioning to eradicate poverty on that one. Also to get clarity on the safety issue. Thank you, Chairperson.
No, okay.
Thank you, Chair. You shouldn't have asked me earlier on why I didn't ask questions. Chairperson, I think, although this hasn't been mentioned by both parties, one has to grasp the prickly nettle using colleague Ibrahim's Rasul's common mistake, use of the word nettle. Because I'm sure you've been following the debate in the media and everywhere else about, from certain parties, one of which will be coming here tomorrow. And whose submission we have, and I think it's public document, about the location. You haven't said anything about it, the location of the Planning Commission. Is it possible for you to share your views with us in that regard? I think you know the views of other parties. Thank you.
Okay. Right. Over to you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you There were a few questions about the white paper, I think from Honourable Member Swart and Trollope, amongst others. We think it's so important, this whole process, that, that even though there is going to be some delays in producing a white paper, we think it is important enough that there should be a proper process that we can get as broad support for this whole issue as possible, and that we can set up properly right from the start. But we don't rush it now, and then halfway through we find out, oh my goodness, we haven't thought through some of the issues properly. Because even ourselves in the chamber, at least, I don't know about Bruce, we have very short time really to think about these issues, and every time you think about it, you and also these discussions also makes you think again about some of your own views which might be wrong, and we also would like to go back and think again about it. Then the other question from Honourable Member Gungubela is the Ministerial Planning Committee versus the clusters. I want to preface the remark by saying that it might be that we don't know how the cluster system works in government, and that is what might have coloured our views. But we think that planning should be a fundamental part, an integrated part of what government does. And that's why we thought, don't now create a new committee that is now from a more theoretical level going to look at planning. Incorporate it into the work of the clusters, and that clusters sit with certain specific problems and that they need to deal with, and they could then feed that back into the planning process. And that's simply why we thought to build it into the existing structures of government rather than creating new structures. But we would be the first to say that, again, you know, we might be wrong with regard to that approach. As far as spatial development is concerned, some very important remarks have been made. And yes, it's Mr. Singh is correct. It's not as Honourable Mr. Singh, that it's not as if we've rejected it. From the chamber side, we felt from the chamber side there's going to be so many other priorities and issues to deal with that it's going to be difficult to deal with this one as well. That's the one reason. But the other reason is some aspects, and Honourable Member Rasool made me think about this, is some aspects of spatial development are the departmental issues that the departments involved should really be involved in. But other issues are national issues. For instance, rural development. We're not giving enough attention to rural development. That is absolutely clear. In the mining industry in the chamber, we are in the process now of integrating the two development vehicles, the chamber's development vehicle and the NUM's development vehicle, into one. And we want to give rural development a good boost with the assistance of government, to assist government in that regard. And that is a spatial development issue, if you think about it, which the NPC can be involved in. But if it looks at, I don't know, Port Elizabeth as an issue and the development in Port Elizabeth and so on, that might again be too detailed an issue. So members have made some good points. The application of responsibility, the application of a lens, as Honourable Member Rasool has referred to. We struggled quite a bit in preparing our inputs, whether we should make a substantive input on the mining industry and how to address it, or whether we should rather look at the process of strategic planning and of the role of the NPC. Having worked through the green paper a few times, we decided on the latter. In other words, look more at the process of strategic planning and the National Planning Commission and so on. And that is why we didn't refer so specifically to the mining industry, with the exception of saying that we also want to be part of this process. But a very critical issue that he raised to some extent in this context was whether we aren't over-considerate of departmental autonomy. I do think that is a fundamental issue. On the one hand, you can't take away too much from departments and start prescribing to them, especially not if you're a planning and advisory planning organization. You can't do that because then the departments are going to say, well, you were responsible, you made the plan. The DGs might have that approach. On the other hand, you cannot allow departments to have total autonomy and to decide absolutely on their own what they want to do. So I suppose the answer is the boring middle ground in this regard, that you shouldn't be over-differential on the one hand, but on the other hand, you shouldn't take away the responsibility of the DGs. And if they come with a plan that is half-baked or that doesn't address the problem, it is sent back. If it is a good plan, it addresses all the issues, then you can incorporate it. So I think that it was a very good point that was made. And then finally, Honourable Member Mashishi, if I heard the name correctly, the controllable and uncontrollable factors that I referred to was mentioned in the context of why the mining industry in South Africa is lagging other mining industries in other countries. And some of the factors that contribute are factors that we have some control over, such as electricity supply, for example. We know about the problems last year, and that is obviously a planning problem, and that is a controllable factor. An uncontrollable factor might be the sharp drop in the commodity prices that we don't have any control over. As far as poverty is concerned, the mining industry plays a critical role in the rural areas, and as I've indicated, we want to play a stronger role in those areas in order to alleviate poverty through these development vehicles, and also trying to access local funding and also international funding to supplement our own funding that we can contribute. And also, to, a lot can be done if we coordinate our activities more better, that we don't get each mining company building clinics within a short distance from each other, for example. And on safety, that is a presentation on its own. We've done a lot on safety on a tripartite basis and as a chamber. We're on the brink of launching what we call a learning hub that we can learn from each other about best practices and the implementation of best practices for safety is concerned. And there have been improvements, but a lot needs to be made, but I don't want to waste the committee's time on that. Thank you, Mr.
Okay, if I could just perhaps add, by saying that we certainly concur with the responses given by Dr. Barker, so I'm not going to repeat some of those points, but just one or two points that perhaps we could add something to. I think just to reaffirm our view that really this is such an important process that it's essential to get it right. And as Dr. Barker has indicated, it's been, in a sense, a voyage of discovery in a very short space of time, as we've gained new insights, even from our first document to our second document. And we think that even today, listening to the questions, I think once again, new insights will come to us. And I think this is saying to us that really this is such a vital issue to get right, that we need to give it the amount of time, and it doesn't have to be 18 months, I don't think, but at least that we should take it to a white paper stage and then to a legislative stage. The legislation, I think, perhaps stemmed to some extent from what I said at the outset, that some of our past experiences of other initiatives and other structures that have not succeeded appear to us to some extent to be caused by the fact that they were not properly consolidated and structured from the beginning. And that perhaps that's a lesson we should take on board. Let's get it right this time. Let's get the planning mechanisms right this time. So that's why we think that to spend a little more time on it and get the right decisions taken would pay handsome dividends in the long term for us. The second issue, which I think resonated with us, and I think in our original document we did say we were looking at the two green papers together in tandem, But the fact is that for the other green paper, there was not a similar structured process. We're still engaged in looking at that side, but we see these two as going in tandem very much. We will make separate submissions on that because we still need to finalize our views on monitoring and evaluation as set out in that green paper. And then the third point is just the issue once again to say, as Dr. Barker also outlined, that in preparing our submission, we really focus less on the issue of the lens of the future rather than how to get this right, how to get these processes and these structures right. We are indeed within Bursa asking ourselves very fundamentally the question of what is business's vision for the future, where do we want to be in 10 or perhaps 15 years' time, what sort of economy, what must be doing. But at the moment, we felt we should concentrate on what the Green Paper was setting up in terms of structures and processes in order to be able to make a meaningful input here today. I think, Chair, I've covered all the points together with Dr. Barker, and I think perhaps Jerry Benacardi may wish to add something to what I've said or to what he said. What about you?
Chair, thank you. Thanks for. I think I just want to reiterate what my colleagues have just said. I think we've had to deal with the green paper actually within a very short space of time, but being aware that we are looking at something that could have major impact in terms of how government functions in this country. And moving from the premise that the efficiency and effectiveness of the economy is very dependent on how it gets things right the first time around in the state. We view this matter very critical, which again talks to why this idea that we keep on putting forward that we've got to create that space of a white paper beyond a green paper, because we do believe that there are some issues that as we go away today, we will still need to engage with in our own minds to say how do we ensure that we don't make the mistakes of the past, but also recognizing that what we're building here is an institution that will enable all of us to have better coordination and accountability. And institutions live beyond all of us, beyond individuals. And there's always that temptation when we create institutions at a particular point in time to build it around ourselves, the individuals around the room. And we would have missed an opportunity. Let me also pause to say, through your chair, when the whole notion of a planning commission came out for the first time, we deliberated very extensively as business, and initially very critical of what we saw as central planning that could have weaknesses of dampening the capacity of the various levels of government to manage their own plans. But having looked very closely and seen from the experiences of the past years, the weaknesses in the lack of coordinated planning and coordination, after looking very clearly and looking at other economies, especially emerging economies who have sat down and were able to map out long-term priorities and objectives that have taken those economies today to the levels where they are playing major parts in the global economy and a major contributor. We saw that part of what enabled them was effective, coordinated central planning. So we really hope that this process will indeed be a process and not be a 1 week or 2 weeks event, so that we engage very clearly, and we also need to look at going to some of the countries that have set up such institutions and acquaint and engage with them to look at the processes that they've gone through, so that we learn from their lessons, Chair, so that we don't repeat the same mistakes. But clearly, as business, we really hope that this is an opportunity for us as a country to get this matter right for the future of our economy. I thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vilagazi and Frank Becker and Mr. Papp. I will not run the risk of trying to summarize or paraphrase what my colleagues have raised earlier on. In the interest of time, what I can simply say is that your submissions, both of them are very, very much involved. And they really require time from our side also to process those issues that you put before us within a very short space of time. You know, and we need to appreciate the fact that despite that lack of time to plan, you have managed to put something together that will go a long way in shaping up what government and business in terms of the green paper. So I really wanted to thank you on that particular matter. But one key issue that you raised with us is that the Planning Commission should not be reduced into a bargaining forum. It must be a body that you seek consensus for all the stakeholders involved to have a common vision, a common plan over a longer term rather than for short-term issues. I think it's a very, very important matter that you raised with us in terms of reaching a broader consensus in terms of the Planning Commission. The other second important matter that I think you've raised over many other issues is the synergy between state training and market policy. You have touched on that particular matter. I think it's quite critical that you look into it. But lastly, the overwhelming view from the House of or the committee itself is that spatial planning, and we also agree that it is the premise on which the Planning Commission may need to actually move forward in terms of dealing with the future and the planning issues in the Commission itself. So these are some of the very few issues that have touched, but there are many issues that have raised, and I think that's the first into our report. And the loop cycle, the feedback process, that is very, very critical for you, and the white paper issue. We'll look into that. But as we speak about white paper, green paper to white paper, we must also factor into consideration the timing of planning itself for the current government, although it's a planning process for a longer vision, probably 2014 or so and so forth, or 2025. Whatever I'm talking about. The cost of not doing it immediately versus the cost of taking a longer process of doing it is something that we need to factor into our planning process. So I thought those are the issues that we're looking into as a committee. And once again, thank you very much for availing yourself. And you know, tomorrow is a very important day. I'm saying this because we are business, the medium term budget policy statement is being released tomorrow. So I'm sure we'll be looking forward to get your comments, how you see this budget, medium-term budget in relation to the rest of the remainder of the financial year. Thank you very much. That announcement, not there for business and the media. We tomorrow are supposed to start at 3 o'clock, but because of the medium term budget statement, we'll start.